What's my assignment there? You'll have to get that from your new commanding officer on the morning of the 15th. That's all I have for you, Detective Bosch. You have your orders. Have a nice weekend. He clicked off, and a dial tone came from the speaker. Bosch looked at Billets. What do you think? Is this some kind of a joke? If it is, it's a good one. Congratulations. But 3 days ago, Irving told me to quit. Then he turns around and sends me downtown. Well, maybe it's because he wants to watch you more closely. They don't call Parker Center the glass house for nothing, Harry. You better be careful. Bosch nodded. On the other hand, she said, we both know you should be down there. You should have never been taken out of there in the first place. Maybe it's just the circle closing. Whatever it is, we're going to miss you. I'll miss you, Harry. You do good work. Bosch nodded his thanks. He made a move toward leaving, but then looked back up at her and smiled. You're not going to believe this, especially in light of what just happened. But we're looking at Trent again. The skateboard. Sid found a link to the boy on it. Billets threw her head back and laughed loudly, loud enough to draw the attention of everyone in the squad room. Well, she said, when Irving hears that, he's definitely going to change RHD to Southeast Division for sure. Her reference was to the gang-infested district at the far end of the city, a posting that would be the pure-form example of freeway therapy. I wouldn't doubt it, Bosch said. Billets dropped the smile and got serious. She asked Bosch about the latest turn in the case and listened intently while he outlined the plan to put together what would basically be a full-life profile on the dead set decorator. I'll tell you what, she said when he was finished. I'll take you guys off rotation. No sense in you pulling a new case if you're splitting for RHD. I'm also authorizing weekend OT, so work on Trent and hit it hard, and let me know. You've got 4 days, Harry. Don't leave this one on the table when you go. Bosch nodded and left the office. On his way back to his space, he knew all eyes in the squad room were on him. He gave nothing away. He sat down at his space and kept his eyes down. So? Edgar eventually whispered. What did you get? RHD. RHD? He had practically yelled it. It would now be known to all in the squad room. Bosch felt his face getting red. He knew everybody else would be looking at him. Jesus Christ, Edgar said. First kids and now you. What am I, fucking chopped liver? Chapter 48 Kind of Blue played on the stereo. Bosch held a bottle of beer and leaned back in the recliner with his eyes closed. It had been a confusing day at the end of a confusing week. He now just wanted to let the music move through him and clear out his insides. He felt sure that what he was looking for he already had in his possession. It was a matter of ordering things and getting rid of the unimportant things that cluttered the view. He and Edgar had worked until 7 before deciding on an early night. Edgar couldn't concentrate. The news of Bosch's transfer had affected him more deeply than it did Bosch. Edgar perceived it as a slight against him because he wasn't chosen to go to RHD. Bosch tried to calm him by assuring him that it was a pit of snakes that Bosch would be entering, but it was no use. Bosch pulled the plug and told his partner to go home, have a drink, and get a good night's sleep. They would work through the weekend gathering information on Trent. Now it was Bosch who was having the drink and falling asleep in his chair. He sensed he was at a threshold of some sort. He was about to begin a new and clearly defined time in his life, a time of higher danger, higher stakes, and higher rewards. It made him smile, now that he knew no one was watching him. The phone rang and Bosch bolted upright. He clicked off the stereo and went into the kitchen. When he answered, a woman's voice told him to hold for Deputy Chief Irving. After a long moment, Irving's voice came on the line. Detective Bosch? Yes? You received your transfer orders today?
Yes, I did.
Good. I wanted to let you know that I made the decision to bring you back to Robbery Homicide Division.
Why is that, Chief?
Because I decided after our last conversation to hold out one last chance to you. This assignment is that chance. You will be in a position where I can watch your moves very closely.
And what position is that?
You were not told? I was just told to report to RHD next pay period. That was it. There was silence on the phone, and Bosch thought now he would find the sand in the engine oil. He was going back to RHD, but as what? He tried to think. What was the worst assignment within the best assignment? Irving finally spoke. You are getting your old job back. Homicide Special. An opening came up today when Detective Thornton turned in his badge.
Thornton.
That is correct. I'll be working with Kiz Ryder? That will be up to Lieutenant Enriquez. But Detective Ryder is currently without a partner and you have an established working relationship with her.
Bosch nodded.
The kitchen was dark. He was elated, but did not want to transmit his feelings over the phone to Irving. As if knowing these thoughts, Irving said, Detective, you may feel as though you fell into the sewer but came out smelling like a rose. Do not think that. Do not make any assumptions. Do not make any mistakes. If you do, I will be there. Am I clear?
Crystal clear.
Irving hung up without another word. Bosch stood there in the dark, holding the phone to his ear until it started making a loud, annoying tone. He hung up and went back into the living room. He thought about calling Kiz and seeing what she knew, but decided he would wait. When he sat back down on the recliner, he felt something hard jab into his hip. He knew it wasn't his gun because he had already unclipped it. He reached into his pocket and came up with his mini cassette recorder. He turned it on and listened to his verbal exchange with Sertain, the TV reporter outside Trent's house on the night he killed himself. Filtering it through the history of what would happen, Bosch felt guilty and thought that maybe he should have done or said more in an effort to stop the reporter. After he heard the car door slam on the tape, he stopped it and hit the rewind button. He realized that he had not yet heard the whole interview with Trent because he had been out of earshot while searching some parts of the house. He decided he would listen to the interview now. It would be a starting point for the weekend's investigation. As he listened, Bosch tried to analyze the words and sentences for new meanings, things that would reveal a killer. All the while, he was warring with his own instincts. As he listened to Trent speak in almost desperate tones, he still felt convinced the man was not the killer, that his protests of innocence had been true. And this, of course, contradicted what he now knew. The skateboard, found in Trent's house, had the dead boy's initials on it, and the year he both got the skateboard and was killed. The skateboard now served as a tombstone of sorts, a marker for Bosch. He finished the Trent interview, but nothing in it, including the parts he had not previously heard, sparked any ideas in him. He rewound the tape and decided to play it again. And it was early in the second go-through that he picked up on something that made his face suddenly grow hot, almost with the feeling of being feverish. He quickly reversed the tape and replayed the exchange between Edgar and Trent that had drawn his attention. He remembered standing in the hallway in Trent's house and listening to this part of the interview, but he had missed its significance until this moment.
Did you like watching the kids play up there in the woods, Mr. Trent?
No. I couldn't see them if they were up in the woods.
On occasion, I would be driving up or walking my dog, when he was alive, and I would see the kids climbing up there. The girl across the street, the Fosters next door, all the kids around here. It's a city-owned right-of-way, the only undeveloped land in the neighborhood. So they went up there to play. Some of the neighbors thought the older ones went up there to smoke cigarettes, and the concern was they would set the whole hillside on fire.
He turned off the tape and went back to the kitchen and the phone. Edgar answered after one ring.
Bosch could tell he had not been asleep. It was only 9 o'clock.
You didn't bring anything home with you, did you?
Like what?
The reverse directory lists?
No, Harry, they're at the office. What's up?
I don't know. Do you remember when you were making that chart on the board today? Was there anybody named Foster on Wonderland?
Foster?
You mean last name of Foster?
Yeah, last name.
He waited. Edgar said nothing.
Jerry, you remember?
Harry, take it easy, I'm thinking.
More silence.
Edgar finally said.
No Foster. None that I can remember.
How sure are you?
Well, Harry, come on. I don't have the board or the lists here. But I think I would have remembered that name.
Why is it so important? What's going on?
I'll call you back.
Bosch took the phone with him out to the dining room table where he had left his briefcase. He opened it and took out the murder book. He quickly turned it to the page that listed the current residents of Wonderland Avenue with their addresses and phone numbers. There were no Fosters on the list. He picked up the phone and punched in a number. After 4 rings, it was answered by a voice he recognized.
Dr. Guillo, this is Detective Bosch. Am I calling too late?
Hello, Detective.
No, it's not too late for me. I spent 40 years getting phone calls at all hours of the night. 9 o'clock? 9 o'clock is for amateurs. How are your various injuries?
They're fine, Doctor.
I'm in a bit of a hurry, and I need to ask you a couple questions about the neighborhood.
Well, go right ahead.
Going way back, 1980 or so, was there ever a family or a couple on the street named Foster?
There was silence as Guillo thought over the question.
No, I don't think so, he finally said. I don't remember anybody named Foster.
Okay, then can you tell me if there was anybody on the street that took in foster kids?
This time Guillo answered without hesitation.
Yes, there was. That was the Blaylocks. Very nice people. They helped many children over the years, taking them in. I admired them greatly.
Bosch wrote the name down on a blank piece of paper at the front of the murder book. He then flipped to report on the neighborhood canvas and saw there was no one named Blaylock currently living on the block.
Do you remember their first names?
Don and Audrey.
What about when they moved from the neighborhood? Do you remember when that was?
Oh, that would have been at least 10 years ago. After the last child was grown, they didn't need that big house anymore. They sold it and moved.
Any idea where they moved to? Are they still local?
Guillo said nothing. Bosch waited.
I'm trying to remember, Guillo said. I know this.
Take your time, Doctor, Bosch said, even though it was the last thing he wanted Guillo to do.
Oh, you know what, Detective, Guillo said. Christmas. I saved all the cards I received in a box, so I know who to send cards to next year.
My wife always did that. Let me put the phone down and get the box. Audrey still sends me a card every year.
Go get the box, Doctor. I'll wait.
Bosch heard the phone being put down.
He nodded to himself. He was going to get it. He tried to think about what this new information could mean, but then decided to wait. He would gather the information and then sift through it after. It took Guillo several minutes to come back to the phone. The whole time, Bosch waited with his pen poised to write the address on the note page.
Okay, Detective Bosch, I've got it here.
Guillo gave him the address, and Bosch almost sighed out loud. Don and Audrey Blaylock had not moved to Alaska or some other far reach of the world. They were still within a car drive. He thanked Guillo and hung up.
Chapter 49. At 8 a.m. Saturday morning, Bosch was sitting in his slickback watching a small wood frame house a block off the main drag in the town of Lone Pine, 3 hours north of Los Angeles in the foothills of the Sierra Nevadas. He was sipping on cold coffee from a plastic cup and had another one just like it, ready to take over when he was finished. His bones ached from the cold and a night spent driving, and then trying to sleep in the car. He had made it to the little mountain town too late to find a motel open. He also knew from experience that coming to Lone Pine without a reservation on a weekend was not advisable anyway. As dawn's light came up, he saw the blue-gray mountain rising in the mist behind the town and reducing it to what it was, insignificant in the face of time and the natural pace of things. Bosch looked up at Mount Whitney, the highest point in California, and knew it had been there long before any human eyes had ever seen it, and would be there long after the last set was gone. Somehow it made it easier to know all that he knew. Bosch was hungry and wanted to go over to one of the diners in town for steak and eggs, but he wouldn't leave his post. If you moved from L.A. to Lone Pine, it wasn't just because you hated the crowds, the smog, and the pace of the big city. It was because you also loved the mountain. And Bosch wasn't going to risk missing Dawn and Audrey Blaylock to a morning mountain hike while he was eating breakfast. He settled for turning the car on and running the heater for 5 minutes. He had been parceling out the heat and the gas that way all night. Bosch watched the house and waited for a light to come on or someone to pick up the newspaper that had been dropped on the driveway from a passing pickup 2 hours earlier. It was a thin roll of newspaper. Bosch knew it wasn't the L.A. Times. People in Lone Pine didn't care about Los Angeles, or its murders, or its detectives. At 9, Bosch saw smoke start to curl out of the house's chimney. A few minutes later, a man of about 60, wearing a down vest, came out and got the paper. After picking it up, he looked a half block down the street to Bosch's car. He then went back inside. Bosch knew his car stood out on the street. He hadn't been trying to hide himself. He was just waiting. He started the car and drove down to the Blaylock's house and pulled into the driveway. When Bosch got to the door, the man he had seen earlier opened it before he had to knock. "Mr. Blaylock?"
"Yeah, that's me."
Bosch showed his badge and ID. "I was wondering if I could talk to you and your wife for a few minutes. It's about a case I'm working."
"You alone?"
"Yeah."
"How long have you been out there?"
Bosch smiled. "Since about 4. Got here too late to get a room."
"Come in. We have coffee on."
"If it's hot, I'll take it." He led Bosch in and pointed him toward a seating arrangement of chairs and a couch near the fireplace. "I'll get my wife and the coffee." Bosch stepped over to the chair nearest the fireplace. He was about to sit down when he noticed all the framed photographs on the wall behind the couch. He stepped over to study them. They were all of children and young adults. They were of all races. 2 had obvious physical or mental handicaps. The foster children. He turned and took the seat closest to the fire and waited. Soon, Blaylock returned with a large mug of steaming coffee. A woman came into the room behind him. She looked a little bit older than her husband. She had eyes still creased by sleep, but a kind face.
"This is my wife, Audrey," Blaylock said. "Do you take your coffee black?"
"Every cop I ever knew took it black." The husband and wife sat next to each other on the couch. "Black's fine." "Did you know a lot of cops?"
"When I was in L.A., I did. I worked 30 years for the city fire department. Quit as a station commander after the 92 riots. That was enough for me. Came in right before Watts and left after 92.
"What is it you want to talk to us about?" Audrey asked, seemingly impatient with her husband's small talk. Bosch nodded. He had his coffee and the introductions were over. "I work homicide. Out of Hollywood Division. I'm on a..."
"I worked 6 years out of 58, Blaylock said, referring to the fire station that was behind the Hollywood Division station house.
Bosch nodded again.
"Don, let the man tell us why he came all the way up here," Audrey said.
"Sorry. Go ahead."
I'm on a case. A homicide up in Laurel Canyon. Your old neighborhood, actually. And we're contacting people who lived on the street back in 1980.
Why then?
Because that is when the homicide took place. They looked at him with puzzled faces.
Is this one of those cold cases? Blaylock said. Because I don't remember anything like that happening in our neighborhood back then.
In a way, it's a cold case. Only the body wasn't discovered until a couple weeks ago. It had been buried up in the woods. In the hills.
Bosch studied their faces.
No tells. Just shock.
Oh my God, Audrey said. You mean all that time we were living there, somebody was dead up there? Our kids used to play up there. Who was it who was killed?
It was a child. A boy, 12 years old. His name was Arthur Delacroix. Does that name mean anything to either of you?
The husband and wife first searched their own memory banks, and then looked at each other and confirmed the results, each shaking their head.
No, not that name, Don Blaylock said.
Where did he live? Audrey Blaylock asked.
Not in the neighborhood, I don't think. No, he lived down in the Miracle Mile area.
It sounds awful, Audrey said.
How was he killed?
He was beaten to death.
If you don't mind, I mean, I know you're curious about it, but I need to ask the question starting out.
Oh, I'm sorry, Audrey said. Please, go on. What else can we tell you?
Well, we're trying to put together a profile of the street, Wonderland Avenue, at that time. You know, so we know who was who and who was where. It's really routine.
Bosch smiled and knew right away it didn't come off as sincere.
And it's been pretty tough so far. The neighborhood has sort of turned over a lot since then. In fact, Dr. Guillot and a man down the street named Hutter are the only residents still there since 1980.
Audrey smiled warmly.
Oh, Paul, he is such a nice man. We still get Christmas cards from him, even since his wife passed away.
Bosch nodded.
Of course, he was too expensive for us. We mostly took our kids to the clinics, but if there was ever an emergency on a weekend or when Paul was home, he never hesitated. Some doctors these days are afraid to do anything because they might get...
I'm sorry.
I'm going off like my husband, and that's not what you came here to hear.
It's all right, Mrs. Blaylock.
You mentioned your kids. I heard from some of the neighbors that you two had a foster home, is that right?
Oh, yes, she said. Don and I took in children for 25 years.
That's a tremendous, thing you did. I admire that.
How many children was it?
It was hard to keep track of them.
We had some for years, some for only weeks. A lot of it was at the whim of the juvenile courts.
It used to break my heart when we were just getting started with a child, you know, making them feel comfortable and at home, and then the child would be ordered home or to the other parent or what have you. I always said that to do foster work, you had to have a big heart with a big callus on it.
She looked at her husband and nodded. He nodded back and reached over and took her hand. He looked back at Bosch.
We counted it up once, he said. We had a total of 38 kids at one time or another. But realistically, we say we raised 17 of them. These were kids that were with us long enough for it to have an impact. You know, anywhere from 2 years to... One child was with us 14 years.
He turned so he could see the wall over the couch and reached up and pointed to a picture of a boy in a wheelchair. He was slightly built and had thick glasses. His wrists were bent at sharp angles. His smile was crooked.
That's Benny, he said.
Amazing, Bosch said. He took a notebook out of his pocket and flipped it open to a blank page. He took out a pen. Just then his cell phone started chirping.
That's me, he said. Don't worry about it.
Don't you want to answer it? Blaylock asked.
They can leave a message. I didn't even think there'd be clear service this close to the mountain.
Yeah. We even get TV.
Bosch looked at him and realized he had somehow been insulting.
Sorry. I didn't mean anything.
I was wondering if you could tell me what children you had living in your home in 1980.
There was a moment when everyone looked at one another and said nothing.
Is one of our kids involved in this? Audrey asked.
I don't know, ma'am. I don't know who was living with you. Like I said, we're trying to put together a profile of that neighborhood. We need to know exactly who was living there. And then we'll go from there.
Well, I'm sure the Division of Youth Services can help you.
Bosch nodded. Actually, they changed the name. It's now called the Department of Children's Services, and they're not going to be able to help us until Monday at the earliest, Mrs. Blaylock.
This is a homicide. We need this information now.
Again, there was a pause as they all looked at one another.
Well, Don Blaylock finally said, it's going to be kind of hard to remember exactly who was with us at any given time. There are some obvious ones, like Benny and Jody and Francis, but every year we'd have a few kids that, like Audrey said, would be dropped in and then taken out. They're the tough ones. Let's see, 1980. He stood up and turned so he could see the breadth of the wall of photos. He pointed to one, a young black boy of about 8. William there.
He was 1980.
No, he wasn't, Audrey said. He came to us in 84. Don't you remember the Olympics? You made him that torch out of foil?
Oh, yeah. 84.
Bosch leaned forward in his seat. The location near the fire was now getting too warm for him.
Let's start with the three you mentioned. Benny and the two others. What were their full names?
He was given their names, and when he asked how they could be contacted, he was given phone numbers for two of them, but not Benny.
Benny passed away 6 years ago, Audrey said.
Multiple sclerosis.
I'm sorry.
He was very dear to us.
Bosch nodded and waited for an appropriate silence to go by.
Who else? Didn't you keep records of who came and for how long?
We did, but we don't have them here, Blaylock said.
They're in storage in L.A.
He suddenly snapped his fingers.
You know, we have a list of the names of every child we tried to help or did help. It's just not by year.
We could probably cut it down a little bit, but would that help you?
Bosch noticed Audrey give her husband a momentary look of anger.
Her husband didn't see it, but Bosch did.
He knew her instincts would be to protect her children from the threat, real or not, that Bosch represented.
Yes, that would help a lot.
Blaylock left the room, and Bosch looked at Audrey.
You don't want him to give me that list.
Why is that, Mrs. Blaylock?
Because I don't think you're being honest with us.
You are looking for something, something that will fit your needs. You don't drive 3 hours in the middle of the night from Los Angeles for a routine questioning, as you call it. You know these children come from tough backgrounds. They weren't all angels when they came to us. And I don't want any of them blamed for something just because of who they were or where they came from.
Bosch waited to make sure she was done.
Mrs. Blaylock, have you ever been to the McLaren Youth Hall?
Of course. Several of our children came from there.
I came from there, too. And an assortment of foster homes where I never lasted very long. So I know what these children were like because I was one myself, all right? And I know that some foster homes can be full of love and some can be just as bad as or worse than the place you were taken from. I know that some foster parents are committed to the children and some are committed to the subsistence checks from Children's Services.
She was quiet a long moment before answering.
It doesn't matter, she said. You still are looking to finish your puzzle with any piece that fits.
You're wrong, Mrs. Blaylock. Wrong about that. Wrong about me.
Blaylock came back into the room with what looked like a green school folder. He placed it down on the square coffee table and opened it.
Its pockets were stuffed with photos and letters.
Audrey continued despite his return.
My husband worked for the city like you do, so he won't want to hear me say this. But, Detective, I don't trust you or the reasons you say you're here. You're not being honest with us.
Audrey, Blaylock yelped. The man is just trying to do his job. And he'll say anything to do it, and he'll hurt any of our children to do it. Audrey, please.
He turned his attention back to Bosch and offered a sheet of paper. There was a list of handwritten names on it. Before Bosch could read them, Blaylock took the page back and put it down on the table. He went to work on it with a pencil, putting check marks next to some of the names. He spoke as he worked. We made this list just so we could sort of keep track of everybody. You'd be surprised. You can love somebody to death, but when it comes time to remember 20, 30 birthdays, you always forget somebody. The ones I'm checking off here are the kids that came in more recent than 1980. Audrey will double-check when I'm done.
No, I won't.
The man ignored her. Bosch's eyes moved ahead of Blaylock's pencil and down the list. Before he was two-thirds to the bottom, he reached down and put his finger on a name. Tell me about him. Blaylock looked up at Bosch and then over at his wife. Who is it? She asked. Johnny Stokes, Bosch said. You had him in your home in 1980, didn't you? Audrey stared at him for a moment.
There, you see, she said to her husband, while looking only at Bosch. He already knew about Johnny when he came in here. I was right. He's not an honest man.
Chapter 50. By the time Don Blaylock went to the kitchen to brew a second pot of coffee, Bosch had two pages of notes on Johnny Stokes. He had come to the Blaylock house through a DYS referral in January 1980, and was gone the following July when he was arrested for stealing a car and going on a joyride through Hollywood. It was his second arrest for car theft. He was incarcerated at the Sylmar Juvenile Hall for 6 months. By the time his period of rehabilitation was completed, he was returned by a judge to his parents. Though the Blaylocks heard from him on occasion and even saw him during his infrequent visits to the neighborhood, they had other children still in their care and soon drifted from contact with the boy. When Blaylock went to make the coffee, Bosch settled into what he thought would be an uncomfortable silence with Audrey. But then she spoke to him.
12 of our children graduated from college, she said. 2 have military careers. 1 followed Don into the fire service. He works in the valley.
She nodded at Bosch, and he nodded back.
We never considered ourselves to be 100% successful with our children, she continued. We did our best with each one. Sometimes the circumstances or the courts or the youth authorities prevented us from helping a child. John was one of those cases. He made a mistake, and it was as if we were to blame. He was taken from us before we could help him.
All Bosch could do was nod.
You seem to know of him already, she said. Have you already spoken to him?
Yes, briefly.
Is he in jail now?
No, he's not.
What has his life been since we knew him?
Bosch spread his hands apart. He hasn't done well. Drugs, a lot of arrests, prison. She nodded sadly.
Do you think he killed that boy in our neighborhood? While he was living with us?
Bosch could tell by her face that if he were to answer truthfully, he would knock down everything she had built out of what was good in what they had done. The whole wall of pictures, the graduation gowns, and the good jobs would mean nothing next to this. I don't really know. But we do know he was a friend of the boy who was killed. She closed her eyes. Not tightly, just as if she were resting them. She said nothing else until Blaylock came back into the room. He went past Bosch and put another log on the fire. Coffee will be up in a minute. Thank you, Bosch said. After Blaylock walked back to the couch, Bosch stood up. I have some things I would like you to look at, if you don't mind. They're in my car. He excused himself and went out to the slickback. He grabbed his briefcase from the front seat and then went to the trunk to get the file box containing the skateboard. He thought it might be worth a try showing it to the Blaylocks. His phone chirped just as he closed the trunk, and this time he answered it.
It was Edgar.
Harry, where are you?
Up in Lone Pine.
Lone Pine? What the fuck are you doing up there?
I don't have time to talk. Where are you?
At the table, like we agreed. I thought you...
Listen, I'll call you back in an hour. Meantime, put out a new bolo on Stokes.
What?
Bosch checked the house to make sure the Blaylocks weren't listening or in sight.
I said, put out another bolo on Stokes. We need him picked up.
Why?
Because he did it. He killed the kid.
What the fuck, Harry?
I'll call you in an hour. Put out the bolo.
He hung up, and this time turned the phone off. Inside the house, Bosch put the file box down on the floor and then opened his briefcase on his lap. He found the envelope containing the family photos borrowed from Sheila Delacroix. He opened it and slid them out. He split the stack in two and gave one half to each of the Blaylocks. Look at the boy in these pictures and tell me if you recognize him. If he ever came to your house, with Johnny or anybody else. He watched as the couple looked at the photos and then exchanged stacks. When they were finished, they both shook their heads and handed the photos back.
Don't recognize him, Don Blaylock said.
Okay, Bosch said as he put the photos back into the envelope. He closed his briefcase and put it on the floor. He then opened the file box and lifted out the skateboard.
Has either of you...
That was John's,
Audrey said. Are you sure?
Yes, I recognize it. When he was taken from us, he left it behind. I told him we had it. I called his house, but he never came for it.
How do you know that this is the one that was his?
I just remember. I didn't like the skull and crossbones. I remember those.
Bosch put the skateboard back in the box.
What happened to it if he never came for it?
We sold it, Audrey said. When Don retired after 30 years and we decided to move up here, we sold all of our junk. We had a gigantic garage sale.
More like a house sale, her husband added. We got rid of everything.
Not everything. You wouldn't sell that stupid fire bell we have in the backyard. Anyway, that was when we sold the skateboard.
Do you remember who you sold it to?
Yes, the man who lived next door, Mr. Trent.
When was this?
Summer of 92, right after we sold the house. We were still in escrow, I remember.
Why do you remember selling the skateboard to Mr. Trent? 92 was a long time ago.
I remember because he bought half of what we were selling. The junky half. He gathered it all up and offered us one price for everything. He needed it all for his work. He was a set designer.
Set decorator, her husband corrected. There is a difference.
Anyway, he used everything he bought from us on movie sets. I always hoped I would see something in a movie that I'd know came from our house. But I never did.
Bosch scribbled some notes in his pad. He had just about everything he needed from the Blaylocks. It was almost time to head south, back to the city to put the case together.
How did you get the skateboard? Audrey asked him.
Bosch looked up from his notepad.
It was in Mr. Trent's possessions.
He's still on the street? Don Blaylock asked.
He was a great neighbor. Never a problem at all with him.
He was until recently, Bosch said. He passed away, though.
Oh, my gosh, Audrey proclaimed. What a shame. And he wasn't that old a man.
I just have a couple more questions, Bosch said. Did John Stokes ever tell either of you how he came to have the skateboard?
He told me that he had won it during a contest with some other boys at school, Audrey said.
The Brethren School?
Yes, that's where he went. He was going when he first came to us, and so we continued it.
Bosch nodded and looked down at his notes. He had everything. He closed the notebook, put it in his coat pocket, and stood up to go. Chapter 51 Bosch pulled the car into a space in front of the Lone Pine Diner. The booths by all the windows were filled, and almost all of the people in them looked out at the LAPD car 200 miles from home. He was starved, but knew he needed to talk to Edgar before delaying any further. He took out the cell phone and made the call. Edgar answered after half a ring.
It's me. Did you put the bolo out?
Yeah, it's out. But it's a little hard to do when you don't know what the fuck is going on, partner.
He said the last word as if it was a synonym for asshole. It was their last case together, and Bosch felt bad that they were going to end their time this way. He knew it was his fault. He had cut Edgar out of the case for reasons Bosch wasn't even sure about.
Jerry, you're right, he said. I fucked up. I just wanted to keep things moving, and that meant driving through the night.
I would have gone with you.
I know, Bosch lied. I just didn't think. I just drove. I'm coming back now.
Well, start at the beginning so I know what the fuck is going on in our own case. I feel like a moron here, putting out a bolo and not even knowing why.
I told you. Stokes is the guy.
Yeah, you told me that and you didn't tell me anything else.
Bosch spent the next 10 minutes watching diners eat their food while he recounted his moves for Edgar and brought him up to date.
Jesus Christ. And we had him right here, Edgar said when Bosch was finished.
Yeah, well, it's too late to worry about that. We have to get him back.
So you're saying that when the kid packed up and ran away, he went to Stokes. Then Stokes leads him up there into the woods and just kills him.
More or less.
Why?
That's what we have to ask him.
I've got a theory, though.
What?
The skateboard?
Yeah. He wanted the skateboard.
He'd kill a kid over a skateboard?
We've both seen it done for less, and we don't know if he intended to kill him or not. It was a shallow grave, dug by hand. Nothing premeditated about that. Maybe he just pushed him and knocked him down. Maybe he hit him with a rock. Maybe there was something else going on between them we don't even know about.
Edgar didn't say anything for a long moment, and Bosch thought maybe they were finished, and he could get some food.
What did the foster parents think about your theory?
Bosch sighed. I didn't really spin it for them.
But put it this way. They weren't too surprised when I started asking questions about Stokes. You know something, Harry? We've been spinning our wheels is what we've been doing.
What do you mean?
This whole case. It comes down to what? A 13-year-old killing a 12-year-old over a fucking toy. Stokes was a juvie when this went down. Ain't nobody gonna prosecute him now.
Bosch thought about this for a moment. They might. Depends on what we get out of him after we pick him up.
You just said yourself there was no sign of pre-med. They're not going to file it, partner, I'm telling you. We've been chasing our tail. We closed the case, but nobody goes away for it.
Bosch knew Edgar was probably right. Under the law, it was rare that adults were prosecuted for crimes committed while they were juveniles as young as 13. Even if they pulled a full confession out of Stokes, he would probably walk.
I should have let her shoot him, he whispered.
What's that, Harry?
Nothing. I'm going to grab something to eat and get on the road. You going to be there?
Yeah, I'm here.
I'll let you know if anything happens.
All right.
He hung up and got out of the car, thinking about the likelihood of Stokes walking away from his crime. As he entered the warm diner and was hit with the smells of grease and breakfast, he suddenly realized he had lost his appetite.
Chapter 52. Bosch was just coming down out of the squiggle of treacherous freeway called the Grapevine when his phone chirped. It was Edgar.
Harry, I've been trying to call you. Where you at?
I was in the mountains. I'm less than an hour out. What's going on?
They've got a fix on Stokes. He's squatting in the Usher.
Bosch thought about this. The Usher was a 1930s hotel a block off Hollywood Boulevard. For decades, it was a weekly flophouse and prostitution center until redevelopment on the boulevard pushed up against it and suddenly made it a valuable property again. It was sold, closed, and ready to go through a major renovation and restoration that would allow it to rejoin the new Hollywood as an elegant grand dame. But the project had been delayed by city planners who held final approval, and in that delay was an opportunity for the denizens of the night.
While the hotel usher awaited rebirth, the rooms on its 13 floors became the homes of squatters who snuck past the fences and plywood barriers to find shelter. In the previous 2 months, Bosch had been inside the usher twice while searching for suspects. There was no electricity, there was no water, but the squatters used the toilets anyway, and the place smelled like an above-ground sewer. There were no doors on any of the rooms, and no furniture. People used rolled-up carpets in the rooms as their beds. It was a nightmare to try to search safely. You moved down the hall and every doorway was open and a possible blind for a gunman. You kept your eyes on the openings and you might step on a needle. Bosch flipped on the car's emergency lights and put his foot hard on the pedal. "How do we know he's in there?" he asked. "From last week when we were looking for him. Some guys and narcs were working something in there and got a line on him squatting all the way up on the 13th floor. You gotta be scared of something to go all the way to the top in a place where the elevator's shut down." "Okay, what's the plan?" "We're gonna go in big. 4 teams from patrol, me and the narcs. We start at the bottom and work our way up."
"When do you go?"
"We're about to go into roll call now and talk it out. Then we go." "We can't wait for you, Harry. We have to take this guy before he gets out and about."
Bosch wondered for a moment if Edgar's hurry was legitimate, or simply an effort to get even with Bosch for him cutting him out of several of the investigative moves on the case. "I know," he finally said. "You gonna have a rover with you?"
"Yeah, we're using Channel 2.
"Okay, I'll see you there. Put your vest on." He said the last not because he was concerned about Stokes being armed, but because he knew a heavily armed team of cops in the enclosed confinement of a dark hotel hallway had danger written all over it. Bosch closed the phone and pushed the pedal down even harder. Soon he crossed the northern perimeter of the city and was in the San Fernando Valley. Saturday traffic was light. He switched freeways twice and was cruising through the Cahuenga Pass into Hollywood a half hour after hanging up with Edgar. As he exited onto Highland, he could see the hotel usher rising a few blocks to the south. Its windows were uniformly dark, the curtains stripped out in preparation for the work ahead. Bosch had no rover with him and had forgotten to ask Edgar where the command post for the search would be located. He didn't want to simply drive up to the hotel in his slickback and risk exposing the operation. He took out his phone and called the watch office. Mankiewicz answered. "Mank, you ever take a day off?"
"Not in January. My kids celebrate Christmas and Hanukkah. I need the OT. What's up?"
"Can you get me the CP location on the thing at the usher?"
"Yeah. It's the parking lot at Hollywood Presbyterian."
"Got it. Thanks." 2 minutes later, Bosch pulled into the church parking lot. There were 5 squad cars parked there along with a slickback and a narc car. The cars were parked up close to the church so that they were shielded from view of the windows of the usher, which rose into the sky on the other side of the church. 2 officers sat in one of the patrol cars. Bosch parked and walked over to the driver's side window. The car was running. Bosch knew it was the pickup car. When the others grabbed Stokes and the usher, a radio call would go out for the pickup. They would drive over and pick up the prisoner. "Where are they?"
12th floor," said the driver.
"Nothing yet.
Let me borrow your rover."
The cop handed his radio out the window to Bosch. Bosch called Edgar on Channel 2.
"Harry, you here?"
"Yeah, I'm coming up."
"We're almost done."
"I'm still coming up." He gave the radio back to the driver and started walking out of the parking lot. When he got to the construction fence that surrounded the usher property, he went to the north end, where he knew he would find the seam in the fence the squatters used to get in. It was partially hidden behind a construction sign announcing the arrival soon of historic luxury apartments. He pulled back the loose fence and ducked through. There were 2 main staircases at either end of the building. Bosch assumed there would be a team of uniform officers posted at the bottom of each, in case Stokes somehow slipped through the search and tried to escape. Bosch took out his badge and held it up and out as he opened the exterior stairwell door on the east side of the building.
As he stepped into the stairwell, he was met by two officers who held their weapons out and at their sides. Bosch nodded, and the cops nodded back. Bosch started up the stairs. He tried to pace himself. Each floor had two runners of stairs and a landing for the turn. He had 24 to climb. The smell from the overflowing toilets was stifling, and all he could think about was what Edgar had told him about all odors being particulate. Sometimes knowledge was an awful thing. The hallway doors had been removed, and with them the floor markings. Though someone had taken it upon himself to paint numbers on the walls of the lower landings, as Bosch got higher, the markings disappeared, and he lost count and became unsure what floor he was on. At either the 9th or 10th floor, he took a breather. He sat down on a reasonably clean step and waited for his breathing to become more regular. The air was cleaner this high up. Fewer squatters used the upper floors of the building because of the climb. Bosch listened, but he heard no human sounds. He knew the search teams had to be on the top floor by now. He was wondering if the tip on Stokes had been wrong, or if the suspect had slipped out. Finally, he stood and started up again. A minute later, he realized he had counted wrong, but in his favor. He stepped up onto the last landing in the open door of the penthouse, the 13th floor. He blew out his breath and almost smiled at the prospect of not having to climb another set of stairs when he heard shouts coming from the hallway.
There! Right there! Stokes, no! Police! Free!
Two quick and brutally loud gunshots sounded and echoed down the hall, obliterating the voices. Bosch drew his gun and quickly moved to the doorway. As he began to peek around the jam, he heard two more shots and pulled back. The echo prevented him from identifying the origin of the shots. He leaned around the jam again and looked into the hallway. It was dark, with light slashing through it from the doorways of the rooms on the west side. He saw Edgar standing in a combat crouch behind two uniformed officers. Their backs were to Bosch, and their weapons were pointed at one of the open doorways. They were 50 feet down the hall from Bosch.
"Clear!" a voice yelled. "We're clear in here!"
The men in the hall raised their weapons up in unison and moved toward the open doorway.
"LAPD in the back!" Bosch yelled, and then stepped into the hallway.
Edgar glanced back at him as he followed the two uniforms into the room. Bosch walked quickly down the hallway and was about to enter the room when he had to step back to let a uniform officer out. He was talking on his rover.
"Central, we need paramedics to 41 Highland, 13th floor. Suspect down, gunshot wounds."
As Bosch entered the room, he looked back. The cop on the rover was Edgewood. Their eyes locked for just a moment, and then Edgewood disappeared into the shadows of the hallway. Bosch turned back to view the room. Stokes was sitting in a closet that had no door. He was leaning back against the rear wall. His hands were in his lap, one holding a small gun, a 25 caliber pocket rocket. He wore black jeans and a sleeveless t-shirt that was covered with his own blood. He had entry wounds on his chest and right below his left eye. His eyes were open, but he was clearly dead. Edgar was squatted in front of the body. He didn't touch it. There was no use trying for a pulse, and everybody knew it. The smell of burnt cordite invaded Bosch's nose, and it was a welcome relief from the smell outside the room. Bosch turned around to take in the whole room. There were too many people in the small space. There were three uniforms, Edgar and a plainclothes Bosch assumed was a narc. Two of the uniforms were huddled together at the far wall, studying two bullet holes in the plaster. One raised a finger and was about to probe one of the holes.
"Don't touch that," Bosch barked. "Don't touch anything. I want everybody to back out of here and wait for OIS.
Who fired a weapon?"
"Edge did it," said the narc.
"The guy was waiting for us in the closet and we..."
"Excuse me, what's your name?"
"Phillips."
"Okay, Phillips, I don't want to hear your story. Save it for OIS.
Go get Edgewood and go back downstairs and wait. When the paramedics get here, tell them never mind. Save them a trip up the steps.
The cops reluctantly shuffled out of the room, leaving only Bosch and Edgar. Edgar got up and walked over to the window. Bosch went to the corner farthest from the closet and looked back at the body. He then approached the body and squatted down in the same spot where Edgar had been. He studied the gun in Stokes's hand. He assumed that when it was removed from the hand, OIS investigators would find the serial number had been burned away by acid. He thought about the shots he had heard while on the stairway landing. 2 and 2. It was hard to judge them by memory, especially considering his position at the time. But he thought the first 2 rounds had been louder and heavier than the second 2. If that was so, it would mean Stokes had fired his little popper after Edgewood had fired his service weapon. It would mean Stokes had gotten off 2 shots after he had been hit in the face and chest. Wounds that appeared instantly fatal to Bosch.
What do you think?
Edgar had come up behind him. It doesn't matter what I think, Bosch said. He's dead. It's an OIS case now.
What it is a closed case, partner. I guess we didn't have to worry about whether the DA would file the case after all.
Bosch nodded. He knew there would be wrap-up investigation and paperwork, but the case was finished. It would ultimately be classified as closed by other means, meaning no trial and no conviction, but carried in the solved column just the same. Guess not, he said. Edgar swatted him on the shoulder.
Our last case together, Harry.
We go out on top.
Yeah.
Tell me something, did you mention the DA and about it being a juvie case during the briefing in the roll call room this morning? After a long moment, Edgar said,
Yeah, I might have mentioned something about it.
Did you tell them we were spinning our wheels, the way you said it to me? That the DA probably wouldn't even file a case on Stokes?
Yeah, I might have said it like that. Why?
Bosch didn't answer. He stood up and walked over to the room's window. He could see the Capitol Records building and farther past it the Hollywood sign up on the crest of the hill. Painted on the side of a building a few blocks away was an anti-smoking sign showing a cowboy with a drooping cigarette in his mouth, accompanied by a warning about cigarettes causing impotence. He turned back to Edgar. You gonna hold the scene until OIS gets here?
Yeah, sure. They're gonna be pissed off about having to hump the 13 floors.
Bosch headed toward the door.
Where you going, Harry?
Bosch walked out of the room without answering. He used the stairwell at the farthest end of the hallway so that he wouldn't catch up to the others as he was going down. Chapter 53. The living members of what had once been a family stood as points of a hard-edged triangle with the grave in the middle. They stood on a sloping hillside in forest lawn, Samuel Delacroix on one side of the coffin, while his ex-wife stood across from him. Sheila Delacroix's spot was at the end of the coffin opposite the preacher. The mother and daughter had black umbrellas open against the light drizzle that had been falling since dawn. The father had none. He stood there getting wet, and neither woman made a move to share her protection with him. The sound of the rain and the freeway hissing nearby drowned out most of what the rented preacher had to say before it got to Bosch. He had no umbrella either, and watched from a distance in the protection of an oak tree. He thought that it was somehow appropriate that the boy should be formally buried on a hill and in the rain. He had called the medical examiner's office to find out which funeral home was handling the service, and it had led him to Forest Lawn. He had also learned that it had been the boy's mother who had claimed the remains and planned the service. Bosch came to the funeral for the boy, and because he wanted to see the mother again. Arthur Delacroix's coffin looked like it had been made for an adult. It was polished gray with brushed chrome handles. As coffins went, it was beautiful, like a newly waxed car. The rain beaded on its surface and then slid down into the hole beneath. But it was still too big for those bones, and somehow that bothered Bosch. It was like seeing a child in ill-fitting clothes, obvious hand-me-downs.